The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I've been away for quite a long time. I was in Massachusetts teaching the three-month course. I taught the last 6 weeks of the three-month course. And so I'm still kind of full with that. And it's such a gift to be in a community, in a group of practitioners that are looking at cultivating their hearts and minds in such an extended way. And so it's so touching to see just how much happens for people on retreat, how much the heart and mind grow and develop. And so tonight, maybe somewhat inspired by that, I wanted to explore how the heart and mind are cultivated in our practice. We often, I think, we talk about mindfulness and cultivating our minds. There's a wisdom component to the teachings often. The first couple of aspects of the path that the Buddha offered, wise understanding and wise intention, are said to be the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path. And so to some extent, the path that the Buddha offers begins with wisdom, of some aspect of cultivating our minds, of understanding. And what it is that the Buddha asked us to understand was suffering, to understand how our minds get involved with themselves and struggle as a result of that. So we begin to explore and understand that our own minds are large participants in why we are suffering. And so this is a big component of the wisdom that we are learning about as we turn mindfulness, as we turn this capacity to explore being in the present moment, knowing what's happening while it's happening. A big part of what the Buddha encourages us to look at is how we are suffering, what's happening there. And so we are asked to understand suffering and begin to recognize that a big piece of how we suffer is because we want things to be other than they are. We want to hold on to things that are pleasant as they're slipping away. We want to get rid of things that are unpleasant, even as we are already in the presence of them. And so we're kind of often fighting the world, fighting what's pleasant and unpleasant. And we are struggling and suffering, reacting to that. And this is not to say that this is a place where it's easy to misunderstand this wisdom that the Buddha offers, where he's encouraging us to look at how our minds contribute to suffering and saying that this craving or clinging for things to be other than they are is a big contribution to our suffering. Sometimes that wisdom is then understood to mean that, well, I'm not supposed to want to change anything. I'm just supposed to sit there and let things happen to me and not complain or something like that. That's a way that this can be interpreted. And yet, what my understanding of this wisdom is that essentially what our minds do is fight with what is already here. And so conditions have come into being that have created what is here in this moment. So something is already here in this moment. And largely our suffering is about not wanting what is already here to be here. So that there's this resistance to what's already happening. And so we're fighting with what's already here, not liking this experience or wanting to hold on to what's happening in this moment, even as it's changing, even as it's moving and shifting and changing. And so the wisdom of the Buddha is pointing to, in this very moment, which is already actually vanishing as we recognize it. This moment is hardly anything at all. But the mind is resisting or fighting with this moment that's here. And instead of recognizing, well, what is here is already here. And what is a skillful way to respond to what is here? So instead of fighting with and having aversion to what is already here, maybe exploring, well, this is what's here. How might it be? What might be an appropriate response? What might be an expression of wisdom's relationship to this experience? Or what might be the expression of love's relationship to this experience? And so the understanding of that reactivity or that suffering is created by our reaction to the present moment doesn't mean that we are not supposed to take action to step into the next moment with some skillful response to what is here. So, for instance, if you are, just the way our bodies work, in fact, it's like if you touch something that's hot, and you know your if you touch a stove, for instance, you know your system will retreat from that because it understands it's retreating from that not because it hates the fire or hates the heat, but because it understands that that is suffering, and this being kind of very naturally wants to protect itself from suffering. And so a very similar approach can happen with this moment's experience, recognizing this is what's happening in this moment, this is what's here, and what might be a skillful step in the next moment? What might be a skillful response to that reality? So it might be that you're in a situation, in a relationship, and realizing that the relationship is creating suffering, creating harm, you know, so like this injustice in the world. And it's not that we are just simply asked to witness injustice and not do anything. The system, our system, can respond to that injustice with a movement of compassion, with a movement of recognizing there's something that our hearts want to step forward to relieve suffering, rather than hating the person or the situation, rather than having anger or aversion to that situation, the heart can respond with compassion and love. And so this is the interesting dynamic that I really see happening around this wisdom that the Buddha offers us. It's a wisdom teaching that we tend to fight with the present moment. We tend to not like what's happening when it's unpleasant. We tend to want to hold on to it when it's pleasant, fight to hold on, fight to get rid of. And yet as we begin to open with some understanding and some wisdom to the experience that's already here, what's happening in this moment? As we open to our own reactivity, as we open to suffering that we're seeing in the world, as we see that with mindfulness and realize and feel that it hurts, our own anger hurts, seeing suffering hurts, that there's a way in which our system begins to recognize this is not useful. That the seeing that anger, for instance, is not a useful response to a situation because we recognize in the moment that anger hurts. This movement of anger has confused us or deluded us often because we think, at least I know from in my own experience, when I began looking at anger, began being mindful of anger. I was kind of surprised at some point to actually recognize, wow, it hurts when I'm angry. It feels painful to be angry. Because before that, I had been believing that somehow this anger was going to make me feel better, was going to improve my life by potentially making the other person feel more miserable or something like that. And so the mind had bought into some kind of story that the anger was telling. And because of that, you know, the idea that, well, this will make me feel better. This is going to make the other person miserable. And then I will feel better because the other person is miserable. It was kind of shocking to see this belief in my mind. But all of those thoughts, all of those ideas were obscuring the pain of the anger in this very being. And so as we turn with mindfulness, direct our attention to our experience, we begin to see the suffering and how it is happening, that anger is suffering, that clinging to something, wanting it to stay, actually creates a tension in our hearts, creates a defensiveness in our hearts, creates a blocking of love and sharing. And so this turning with attention to using the wisdom of the Buddha's teaching, which is basically understand suffering. When you are suffering, or when you see suffering in the world, start to look at it and explore it. And in that turning towards that, we begin to directly touch our own suffering and the suffering of others. And this creates the conditions for the heart to respond in a different way. When our heart is more open and meeting what's actually here, meeting suffering, there's a natural response of compassion in the heart. And so in a very interesting dynamic, as we cultivate this wisdom that the Buddha asks us to explore, as we cultivate wise view, as we cultivate seeing our experience and exploring, well, how is this suffering happening? What's going on in here? As we do that, it simultaneously creates the conditions not only for the development of wisdom, but also for our hearts to open. So there's this interplay in our practice between wisdom and love and compassion. The very same practice, the very same exploration, when we orient our mindfulness to our experience using this perspective of wisdom that the Buddha offers, it opens our hearts. And so wisdom and love in the Buddhist teachings I see as intimately connected. Intimately connected. In fact, the Buddha, the term for when we talk about awakening our minds, awakening our hearts, the term that's used in the Buddha's language for mind is citta. And that same word is also used for heart. And so the path of our practice is to open to what is happening in this citta. And when we say mindfulness, when we talk about being mindful, you know, we could just as well talk about being heartful, being connected, being intimate with our experience. So other words that kind of bring in more the heart quality of the practice. So there's this capacity of our practice of the sati, of the mindfulness, it's a cultivation of both the mind and the heart. In our culture, we tend to have these as kind of separate ideas or separate notions. We think of the mind as associated with thought, ideas, with wisdom, with concepts. We think of the heart as being associated with emotions and the whole range of emotions, from anger to love and compassion and peace. But in the Buddha's understanding, these two are just intimately connected. And so in very many ways, the path that the Buddha asked us to travel, the waking up of this heart is the waking up of the heart mind. Waking up of this, the wisdom that is taught to explore our practice through this perspective of understanding our hearts and minds, not only cultivates this deep understanding of some of the ways that wisdom is expressed in the teachings. There's understanding that all experience is impermanent and unreliable and not self. And that sounds so heady. It can sound very heady. It can sound very intellectual. But the experience of opening to the wisdom has a transformative effect on our hearts and our relationships and our connections with other beings in this world. And so there was this emphasis on wisdom, and yet there's also that the Buddha also talks a lot in the suttas about heart qualities. He emphasizes the quality of love, of compassion, of empathetic joy, of joy that resonates when somebody else is experiencing joy. And so he emphasizes these heart qualities in his teachings. And yet the wisdom still seems to take the fore in the Eightfold Path. And yet there's one teaching that kind of inspired me to explore what I'm going to talk about tonight. There's a teaching, one of the teachings where the Buddha talks about understanding suffering, basically. The first part of this text talks about we need to understand all of the reactivity in our minds. Understand it and abandon it. Look at, you know, all of these, you know, anger and confusion and hatred and pride and conceit and all of these reactive components in our mind, and he encourages us to understand them and let them go. And in my own understanding of what that means is that when we turn with mindfulness to all of these reactivities, pick anger again, just it's one that I've looked at a lot. I'll pick impatience. Impatience. Try impatience this time. Turn to something like impatience with mindfulness. Understanding impatience means opening to the experience of it. Now, the teaching says, with the understanding of impatience, it is abandoned. And so this is really pointing to how the understanding frees us. And so when we begin to recognize, well, what is impatience? Well, it's this mind that's looking into the future and thinking about how things should be, and that perhaps it's not liking what's here and wanting this to be over quickly and projecting into the future, thinking that's going to be better. And so the mind is kind of doing this comparing between now and the future. In one form of impatience, it's doing that kind of comparing, and it's not really landing here. And so it's devaluing the present moment with some idea about the future being better, perhaps. And so this is a sense of, this is not okay. What's happening right now is not okay. And so we begin to look at that with our mindfulness and begin to recognize that this projecting into the future is creating a kind of tension in the mind. And if we can actually land in the experience here and now, well, maybe there's a little bit of unpleasantness happening. I find often this impatience arises around transitions and a feeling of, okay, enough already. This is almost over. Let me just get to the next thing. And so there's this the mind is not quite willing to go through the falling apart of something. So there's a little bit of unpleasantness, a little bit of sense of dissatisfaction of the falling apart of something and wanting to get to the next thing that's going to be more pleasant. And yet when I actually look at what's falling apart and what's going on there, there's way more reactivity than it often deserves. And so seeing this, the mind begins to recognize that the experience of suffering in that moment is largely created by a reactivity and not something that's inherent in the experience itself. And so the understanding of the suffering, the understanding of the impatience begins to kind of allow the mind to let go of it. And so this is the abandoning. And this is my sense of how the abandoning actually works. It's the understanding that leads to the abandoning. And so all of this sounds pretty much wisdom related at this point. And yet this teaching goes on to say that once these reactive emotions have been released through this understanding, that there's a very natural development of heart qualities, of faith, of happiness, and concentration resulting. And with that concentration, very naturally, love arises, compassion arises, joy arises. And so this was interesting to me because this teaching talks about starting with this understanding of our suffering, starting with that understanding, very naturally the heart will move in the direction of love. And I began to be curious about that. What is it about this path of practice that allows that to happen? And so I thought that, well, the whole path of practice is laid out in the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, on the surface of it, doesn't look like it would contain a cultivation of love, wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And yet, when I started to look at each of those path factors, I saw there's a way in which with every one of them, this cultivation of heart and mind is already interwoven. And so the very first one, wise view, wise understanding, the kind of classical definition of wise view is this understanding of the Eightfold Path. That there is suffering, it needs to be understood, that there is the cause of suffering is this clinging, this craving, and that it is possible to be free from this suffering. And this is the hope of the practice, and that there is a path that leads to this freedom from suffering. And this freedom from suffering is described as the greatest happiness. And so the whole of the path of practice, while framed in terms of suffering, in some ways it's framed in terms of suffering, understanding suffering, letting go of the cause of suffering, the whole purpose leads us towards happiness. And the other piece of this is that the Buddha pointed us to those ways in which we're caught. The things that create suffering are essentially kind of blocking this open heart. There's one place where the Buddha says something like, this heart is luminous and radiant, but it is obscured. This luminance and radiance is obscured by reactivity, obscured by things that keep it from peace and happiness, essentially. And so he highlighted things that get in the way of well-being in this first path factor. And so the other way that this wise view, wise understanding, points to the heart qualities is that there's a way that he said that freedom, or what gets let go of, are greed, aversion, and delusion. And he said that the result, this happiness, the happiness of freedom, is that the mind is not contracted by greed, aversion, and delusion. And so non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. But if we look at what those are, what is non-greed? It's actually not just the absence of holding on. It's an open hand. It's a generous heart. When we look at what's the absence of aversion, the absence of pushing away, it's a heart that's more connected. Actually, a heart of love. And the absence of delusion, we could say, is wisdom. And so this absence of greed, aversion, and delusion connects us to generosity and love, along with wisdom. The second factor of the path, wise intention, there's a teaching that the teaching of wise intention is that the intention towards non-ill will, letting go, and the intention towards non-cruelty. And again, it's framed in terms of what we're releasing. So we're releasing our clinging to sense pleasure, basically, is one piece of this intention, is looking towards letting go of how we're captivated by pleasant experience. And this is, you know, this is, it's not, it's this understanding, just briefly, is not a, it's not saying that denigrating sense pleasure, to say sense pleasure is bad, but it is rather pointing to the way that we hold on to it is a misunderstanding, is a kind of a misconstruing of where happiness will be found. Partly because we have many times in our lives found a kind of happiness through holding on to sense pleasure, through creating or trying to construct our lives to get things that we want, get rid of things that we don't want. And so there's this we're kind of caught in this cycle of this kind of belief that sense pleasure is where I'll find happiness. And the Buddha acknowledges there's a kind of happiness that does come with sense pleasure. But he says that this is the least kind of happiness that's available to human beings. It is not very reliable, because the things that we're clinging to, the things that we're trying to hold on to, are so unreliable. And so he's really pointing us through this relinquishment of sense pleasure to a higher kind, a more reliable kind of happiness that's hard for our minds to fathom until we get a taste of it through this practice. So the relinquishing, the clinging to sense pleasure begins to support the possibility of seeing a deeper kind of happiness, a deeper kind, and again, the heart quality of intimacy, of really deeply connecting to our experience, begins to point out that even as we cling to something that we like, even as we hold on to thinking that we're happy because we're holding on to something that we want, we begin to see that that clinging itself, the intimacy of our experience points out that that clinging hurts. That holding on to constricts the heart and doesn't allow our hearts to be responsive and receptive to the changing dynamic flow of experience. We've kind of got a lockdown on our hearts, trying to keep things from changing. But the inevitability of things is that they will change. And so this relinquishment of sense pleasure is about allowing a greater intimacy with what is actually happening in our experience. And then these other intentions, intention towards non-ill will and non-cruelty, these two relate to the intention towards love and compassion in relationship with other human beings and in relationship to ourselves. That we explore, how do I want to connect with my intentions to why I act, when I speak, when I act? Can these be motivated? Can these actions be connected to the intentions of love and compassion, rather than being motivated by our usual habitual reactive intentions of frustration or anger or confusion or greed or fear? So much of our actions come from those kinds of motivations. And so this path factor is asking us to look at that and explore the possibility that love and compassion and wisdom can motivate our hearts. So again, love right there. Love and compassion in the Eightfold Path. And then in the aspect of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood, these are the areas of ethical conduct in the Eightfold Path. And really, when I think about ethical conduct in the Eightfold Path, the Buddha's encouragement there is towards non-harming. Connection with our fellow human beings, recognizing that if I want to be free of suffering myself, that it would be useful to not create suffering in the world in relationship with others. And so exploring the relational aspect of our practice. And this is a big field for the cultivation of compassion, kindness. This movement towards non-harming, this connection towards our fellow human beings, and seeing we are all in this together. We are all, as we start to look at our own hearts and minds and see how much of our actions are motivated by our own reactivity, and see how much confusion motivates our own hearts and minds, we begin to recognize, wow, you know, this is not something that's easy to change. It's not something that we can just simply say, oh, I see this motivation of frustration, and yeah, I'll stop doing that. You know, we begin to see just how much the conditioned nature of our experience, how much we are conditioned, and our responses to the world are often motivated by our conditioning. And so this is some wisdom that becomes apparent when we start to see our own relationships to other people in the world. We see that we react out of our conditioning. And this is not something that's easy to change. It is possible. The tools of of the mindfulness and the investigation and the wisdom that the Buddha offers helps us to recognize that the habitual reactivity that we think something about that those habitual reactivities thinks it's doing something for us, thinks it's getting us somewhere. But we start to look at our own experience in those situations and feel the suffering of our own confusion, our own impatience, our own frustration, our own anger, our own reactivity. And we see this is conditioned, and it's not easy to change. And yet the seeing of it begins to inspire us to take a pause when we see, as we begin to see our motivations towards action being motivated by these unskillful, familiar habits and patterns, we start to see that there'd be a value in taking a pause and maybe refraining from action. And this is really the domain of sila, is looking at refraining from actions that are motivated out of these habitual reactive energies. And so we start to see that in our own hearts and minds. We're inspired to potentially refrain from acting out of harmful energies. And we also see how hard it is for others to do the same, because we see in our own hearts and minds how hard it is. And so this exploration around our own ethical conduct begins to connect us. It's a powerful metta practice to explore. It's a powerful practice of love and compassion to explore our own relationship to harm, to non-harming. And we also begin to appreciate the possibility of forgiveness for ourselves, for our own, recognizing the conditioned nature of our own responses to the world. There's kind of a heartbreaking realization that, wow, you know, I would really like to not be motivated by this reactivity, but we see just how strong the impulse is from our conditioning. And we recognize that we are not alone in this. That everybody is working with this same, struggling with this same kind of issue in their mind. Early on in my practice, as I was exploring my anger, I got a taste of this, the sense of this connection, the sense of how the wisdom teaching of the Buddha opens the heart in this way. I was noticing in my own heart this anger and recognizing this impulse, this movement in my heart that really wanted the other person to be miserable when I was angry. And that shocked me. It was painful to realize that this mind actively wished somebody else harm. Through that feeling of anger, there was the wish that somebody else would be miserable. And so there was this wishing of harm for somebody. And in that, in the seeing of that, there was the recognition not only of the pain of the anger, but the pain of the wishing somebody else be harmed. And the recognition that this was not just about me. The way this was framed in my mind was, oh my gosh, this is how wars begin. That the recognition that this heart and mind wishing for harm in another person, that kind of, it was a big deal, this anger, the whole thing that I was angry about was a pretty big deal in my life. But the the, you know, the it being just an individual, a kind of an individual anger, it wasn't, you know, multiplied so much. But I saw in that moment that this kind of process was not only going on in me, but also going on in 7 billion other people on the planet. And there was this kind of heartbreaking realization of how and why there's so much suffering in the world. And an opening of the heart to a kind of, you know, a recognition of, I can't judge. You know, somehow the mind had kind of held itself apart from all of the awful other things happening on this planet. And then realizing, you know, this heart too has that capacity to wish harm. And the recognition in that moment was, I want to do this practice to help free this heart from that. And so there was this connection not only with the sense of freeing this heart and opening this heart to not having that hatred and not having that kind of non-love, but also recognizing that this was not just about me as an individual, that it's something, that it's not personal in fact, that everybody is subject to this kind of tumbling on and this kind of reactivity, and that it multiplies together to create everything. All of the wars, all of the confusion. And so this exploration around sila really does connect us to the non-harming and the opening us to a broader sense of love and compassion in our practice. And then I'm just going to talk briefly about the last three, so there's hopefully a little time for conversation. Wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. These three are really the meditative aspect of the Eightfold Path. And they're the part where we're asked to turn towards our experience and look at our experience. Look at what's going on in there. Be curious about it. Look at what's happening in the present moment while it's happening, being aware that this is what's happening in the present moment. In that exploration of wise effort, wise mindfulness, we're really asked to explore and allow what is happening in our experience. So we're exploring this investigation of, okay, yes, this is what's arising right now. When I talked earlier about understanding our reactivity, this is really what wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration support us in, is meeting our reactivity, meeting all of what happens in our hearts and minds. And so we explore not, oh, anger is arising, frustration is arising, this is bad, I need to get rid of it. The encouragement is, what's happening here? What can I understand this? So that the heart, so that example I gave around watching the anger and seeing how the mind, that anger was creating the conditions for me to want somebody else to be harmed, that was an understanding that helped the mind to let go a little bit of that anger. And so the understanding that comes through the investigation begins to help to free our hearts from these energies. But we're asked essentially to hold these reactivities in our hearts and minds with mindfulness. So sometimes when I give instructions or meditation instructions, I explore kind of a three-part instruction. Relax. Relax the body and receive what's happening. Relax and receive. And then see, can it be allowed? Can we allow, not this allowing piece of the instructions in the this part of the Eightfold Path, the allowing piece of the instruction is about, not about following through on reactivity, but it's a kind of the delicate balance of opening to and meeting what's arising, allowing mindfulness to have an intimacy with that reactivity, but not acting out on that reactivity. And so the allowing is asking us neither to repress our reactivity nor express it. Typically, we would think that if we don't express something, it would mean we have to repress it. And this, the practice of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, is really this middle way. The Buddha talked about the Eightfold Path being a middle way, and this is a big piece of that middle way, is that we explore holding what's happening, holding our reactivity with a heart that can allow it, but not act out on it. This is a learning how to do that. So this allowing attention, the allowing mindfulness, that essentially allows us to open to every single part of ourselves. You know, when we want to be loved, if we want somebody to love us, we in some ways really want all of ourselves to be loved. We want to be seen in some way or fashion. We want somebody to love all of us, the whole messy stuff. And we want to be able to be ourselves fully with somebody. That's what that in some ways we think that would be the you know, unconditional love, receiving us fully for who we are. That is what wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration are exploring doing for ourselves. Seeing ourselves fully, opening to ourselves fully, not rejecting, repressing, denying any part of ourselves, fully witnessing, fully seeing ourselves. This is an expression of love. We want this from somebody else, but really I think this piece of the Eightfold Path is pointing out that this really, this love, loving attention, we might say, loving mindfulness, is possible for our own hearts and minds in a greater depth than anybody else probably can offer it to us. So really, this piece, in a way, supports us being seen by ourselves, being loved by ourselves. So to me, this wisdom path so fully opens us to loving ourselves. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful practice. And yet when I first started this meditation practice, this was not the way I approached it. It was so much, you know, I am going to get in there and I am going to get rid of all of this bad stuff. And it was really when I started to explore fully allowing that transformation began. So this path, the Eightfold Path, both cultivates this wisdom and understanding, and at the same time, if we're open to it, cultivates love. Not only love for our fellow human beings, but also love for ourselves. And this is the definition of unconditional love, actually. The quality of metta is boundless and non-discriminatory. It is equally felt for all beings and ourselves. And this path really flows in so many ways between this wisdom and this opening the heart to love. So there's a couple minutes if there's any thoughts or comments or questions about what I've offered. Yeah.
Would you say that the inherent definition of citta as body, as heart and mind, implies that mindfulness will open people to compassion?
I think that mindfulness does open people to compassion. And maybe it is partly because I don't know that it's necessary to have the definition, that it's related necessarily to the definition of citta being heart and mind. I think that's more of a kind of a different, almost cultural perspective on heart and mind, is that it's used, that it's one word. But whether or not we think of heart and mind as two things or as one thing, the practice of mindfulness will open the heart.
That's my experience also. Would you say it's an interpretation that has developed, or would you say that is an expression within the early literature of the Buddha also? The fact that mindfulness, that compassion arises naturally from mindfulness.
It is very clearly in the suttas that compassion arises naturally from mindfulness. Yeah, that one sutta that I was talking about, it's very clear that it's a very natural unfolding. You know, and another way to recognize this is that as we really begin to open to the wisdom, you know, some of the wisdom we open to is the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience. And as I pointed to, you know, when we with mindfulness begin to see that experience is impermanent and unreliable, we recognize it's not just for us that it's impermanent and unreliable, but it's for everybody that it's impermanent and unreliable. And because of that, the compassion is very naturally coming up, because we recognize that, wow, this being suffers and others suffer. And when that suffering is felt, when that suffering is felt when the heart is open, that is compassion. So as the mind with its concentration and clarity really begins to understand the impermanent, unreliable nature of this experience, it understands it broadly. And the heart, like, just breaks with the poignancy of it. And so that is the movement of compassion. Yeah. When it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention.